And we'll go in 1, 2, 3. What's up, everyone? It's Andrew Bermudez. That's the first time I screwed it up. I'm usually like say the same thing over and over. I started thinking of a rhinoceros, and you'll be able to tell why. And I started laughing in my head. What's up, everyone? It's Andrew Bermudez, co-founder and CEO of Digzy, the commercial real estate search engine to find office space, industrial space, any commercial real estate for lease and sale. So go list your properties for free on Digzy. And if you're looking for a commercial property to lease, buy, or invest in, go to getdigzy.com. I've got a wonderful guest who's going to be actually hopefully co-hosting with us sometime in the next coming month, Carly Iacono with Marcus Millichap. Carly, say hello.
Hello, Andrew. Thank you so much for having me on. Great to see you.
And I want to tell the audience, so the reason why I'm bringing Carly here is she's such a badass that when she travels and takes vacation and she goes to Africa, when she gets off the Jeep, that she starts chasing the rhinoceros and they actually start running away from her and they're scared and they go behind the mountain. So Carly, that's amazing. I don't know how you do that. You have to show me. Most of the time I won't even get out of the Jeep. So
I usually keep it under wraps, but now that it's out there, true story.
I love it. So Carly, today's topic is actually really interesting, right? We're going to talk about how to recognize and actually find great investment deals, whether you're a person starting out or whether you're somebody established. And this can be applied to developers, investors, existing investors, brokers, some of the things that you do for your clients already, right? So give us a little bit about your background so people understand like where you come from and why you have the authority to talk about this stuff.
Absolutely. So I lead an investment sales team at Marcus & Millichap. We are one of the top teams in the country. We do a ton of volume, primarily in the net lease space. We do cover all 50 states, all different markets, and a wide range of different asset classes within net lease primarily. And we work with a lot of new investors. So people will come to us if they're transitioning from, let's say, multifamily or industrial, and they're looking for passive income, or if they're new to real estate in general, maybe they're coming from the stock market and they're looking for something with long-term stability and a way to build generational wealth. So we do work in very strongly with an educational platform to just get people up to speed who are new to the industry. And then we also have a lot of clients who are developers and REITs that we will sell for as they're bringing new product to market. So we do span a very wide spectrum of the investor scale and a lot of different markets.
So you're very active on social media. So let's talk about that because that's how you and I connected, right? So you do a lot of videos. A lot of people know you. There's a few of us in the commercial real estate sphere who people know our names pervasively, and you're one of them. So just tell me a little bit about like, I know that you're focused on new investors, existing investors, et cetera. Has that helped your visibility in helping you find deals in the market for your customers?
Absolutely, Andrew. So commercial real estate historically has been a closed door, very kind of not transparent, hard to enter market. If you are new, maybe you're a doctor and you've made a good amount of wealth, but you don't know a lot about commercial real estate, you have absolutely no idea where to go. Maybe you see a billboard or an ad in a magazine. There's not a lot of transparency in the industry. So getting our name out there and getting that visibility has been paramount to reach people who are new to the industry. And then in terms of deal sourcing, having a clear, consistent brand on the brokerage side is absolutely crucial. We have a lot of relationships in the industry with other brokers, with owners. We have access to inventory on market, off market. We really have our pulse on everything that's going on. So that's a huge value, of course, for any of our clients that are coming to us looking to source deals because we are very interconnected. It's a big industry, but when you really get down to it, there's not that many people who are doing deals. So being at the forefront and having that network really is important.
So what is necessarily a good deal? Is it like the buy low, sell high, or is it, you know, you see something that's priced and there's like a play, like a creative play around it. Like, can you just tell us kind of like that couple or multiple, like the top few things that like define a good investment opportunity?
So that question could not be any broader. So just get comfortable. We'll need about 4 hours. I'm kidding. There's a lot to it, honestly. And I would start with, what is the investment objective? So for some clients, the objective is stability. We have clients who come to us with estate planning needs, and they say, I'm thinking of this for two generations from now. I want my principal to be preserved, and I want a stable cash flow. I'm less concerned with return on the front end. Then we have investors who say, I'm in growth mode. I'm in my 40s, and I have a long road of work ahead of me, but I have put some money aside. I want something that's a higher yield, and I'm willing to take on a little more risk. What kind of deal should I be looking at? We have people who want to be involved in the management of the real estate. They don't want something passive. Maybe they're looking to transition their career. So I would start by saying what a good deal is very much depends on who's asking and what they want to get out of that deal.
Makes sense, yeah.
Now, if you dive in a little deeper, there are characteristics that broad scope everyone should be thinking about with real estate. I'll kind of list them. We won't go into too much detail now, but location, 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 cliche, but true. And that's not necessarily limited to an A-class market. So you don't have to be in the heart of Charlotte, which is one of our fastest growing markets, or LA. You can be in a secondary market, but you want to have a good position in the market. You want to have some population growth. You want to have some demand for whatever your asset is long term. So location is important, access to the site. There's a lot of things that go into location. Second would be your tenant. If it's an investment property, there's most likely going to be a tenant already in place. So how stable that tenant is, it varies widely. It could be a CVS with a corporate guarantee under a 20-year lease, or it could be a mom and pop restaurant owner on a 2-year lease. So the strength of that income stream is hugely diverse in just those two examples. And of course, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of examples. So who your tenant is another consideration. What your lease structure looks like. Are there any management responsibilities? How long is the lease? What do the options look like? Are there increases in your rent? All of that plays into it. And then of course, your return. How much money, leveraged and unleveraged, meaning with debt and without debt, will you be receiving each year? And a lot of people come to us and start with return. I want to make this, but that's not the best place to start. It's again, what are your objectives? What do you want to get out of this investment? And then how do we back into what fits for you?
That makes sense. So is there a, if the tenant is, let's say, corporate credit, higher credit tenant, does that affect the return? Like, because, you know, the prettiest person at the dance has plenty of options on who they want to dance with, right? So they can be picky and offer less than, let's say, somebody who doesn't have those characteristics, might have challenges, you know, attracting, let's say, in this case, an investor. So high corporate credit, and does that affect the return, which they call the cap rate, the capitalization rate?
Absolutely.
So does it go down the higher the credit?
Exactly.
Okay.
Everything is risk return reward. Risk reward.
The lower the risk, the higher the price, right? Yeah.
Right. The lower the return.
So that makes sense.
Things kind of trade in a range based on asset class, but then something with a shorter term lease is considered more risky than a longer term lease in most cases.
Yeah, that makes
Corporate
sense.
Credit less risky than, you know, local operators.
What are some of the assets, like the type of assets? Because you do a lot of like triple net stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are there common themes across the country that you're seeing? Like, are drive-throughs moving more, or let's say, like this type of investments moves more than some others? Like, where have you seen like people have the most? Which properties have the most magnetism and attracting more and more investors that are saying, "Hey, I want that. I want that."
In the short term, it's been our essential retailers, as you might expect. So everyone is very comfortable right now with drugstores for their long-term viability and credit. Both CVS and Walgreens have investment-grade credit. Rite Aid's its own story, not nearly as strong. Drugstores are great. Fast food has had a tremendous resurgence. It was doing well before. Now it is really, really in demand. And that is exactly what you said, drive-throughs. People want convenience. And that model, no matter who the operator is here to stay. It was working pre-COVID. Now we've seen the importance of flexibility, contactless, quick pickup, all those things that people want have just been increased. Mm-hmm. So drive-thrus are a huge focus. Fast food is phenomenal. On the flip side of that, fast casual restaurants, so your sit down, let's call it like an Applebee's, Olive Garden, things like that, are a lot less in demand because they're not as flexible in their income stream. And that, yeah. You know, a lot of them have really, really suffered. What's interesting about net lease is it's really every type of business that you see when you drive down the street. Virtually no companies own their own real estate. And most people who are new to the industry don't realize that. So if you're wondering, what is an investment property look like? What are my choices? Just take a drive. It's everything that you see, every household name, even some hospital systems, some urgent cares. You know, there's a lot of different types. But any national brand and some of the regional ones are almost always under net lease as investment properties.
Which ones have like dropped the attractiveness like most severely? Like, is it the strip mall or is it?
Yeah, multi-tenant retail is tough right now. I do think it's going to come back. We'll see some bifurcation depending on market, meaning the well-located, denser areas that retail I expect to come back a lot quicker. Some of the more tertiary markets, which didn't have as many credit tenants. A lot of your local restaurants and businesses may not make it through COVID. There's a lot of uncertainty there. So local retail without credit has been difficult, not impossible, but difficult to transact. We haven't seen a ton of price discovery yet, meaning the pricing hasn't dramatically shifted. We get a lot of calls saying, you know, I want double the return. It's not there yet. But I do think that next wave of pain in multi-tenant retail is definitely coming.
Yeah, it's like, well, everybody expects it to be somewhere, but the decisions haven't yet been made. So like everything's up in the air right now. But it's funny, the expectations between people, simply because we just don't know. I mean, we're in the middle of it, right? So So we talked about like it depends on your goals, right? But if Carly Iacono went out as an investor today, let's say you got all the capital and you decided to go out and investing on properties, knowing what you know, like where your affinities would go, like what would you and maybe your partners or you form a fund or a syndicate, like what would you go after?
I really like convenience right now. 7-Eleven has phenomenal credit. They're one of our few tenants that are in expansion mode. Their financials are very strong. They're expanding corporately with some really nice new build outs. Wawa's doing great. I really like fast food, like I mentioned. It doesn't have to be corporate. There's some great franchisees who are very dedicated to their business and who run a tight ship and operate really nice restaurants. And by really nice, I mean profitable. Mm-hmm. Taco Bell is a Taco Bell. I don't know how nice or not nice they are, but they do a great job from the business management side. There's some interesting, more speculative areas of the market to watch. Urgent care is not there yet, but I think medical net lease is an evolving part of the market, which we can go into more depth. So that's not something I would be excited about today, but maybe in 5 years, I think that'll be interesting. Drugstores are a safe play. I think you could put your money in a CVS and set it and forget it, but you're not going to really have any income growth. So that's a bit concerning from an inflationary standpoint. Those are the main segments I think that are most exciting right now. Gyms have been hit hard. Daycare is down, but I think we'll bounce back. So, you know, we're kind of in this period of flux, but any tenant base that has been paying rent through COVID has shown that they can weather turmoil and instability from a corporate financial perspective. Those are the companies that we're seeing most demand and I think are the most stable based on what we know right now.
Yeah. So let's talk about this. Most people that want to invest in real estate think that they can just go to, you know, Digzy or Zillow and just find listings everywhere. And they just don't understand how competitive it is. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about finding deals, right? You know, I was in commercial real estate for a long time and it's really interesting in the investment. There usually isn't any investments. And if it is an investment that's listed, there's a reason why it's being marketed to a broad appeal. I mean, most deals actually end up trading within a few phone calls before they even hit the market. There is no MLS in commercial real estate, so it's not like you're forced to put it online or share it. So how do you find good deals? Like how does an investor like find these opportunities? Because it's not, you just can't go on the internet. Yeah, you'll see some, but now you're competing with a bunch of people too. And that's what they don't understand, is that being an investor kind of sucks, because you kind of have to know how to get wind of these transactions.
You need a really good broker. And I mean that not self-serving at all, but it's true. You need, this is not like residential where you can go on Zillow and figure out most things about the house and the neighborhood and be set. You're going to have access as an investor to marketing, offering memorandums, which are a great first step. But like to your point, many of the deals that investors see online in commercial real estate are no longer available. We market them to attract new clients, to get the word out about the deal, to get backup offers. But it is a very fast-paced market. And a lot of investors start by just Googling, calling, and then they'll call every broker that they see listed on whatever random deal. And it does not take long for them to get overwhelmed. So that is not a good approach. I would say if you're new to the industry, do some research online, but you really do need to find a good broker that you, that you trust to kind of weed through it. And a lot of the deals are relationship-based. That's what I mentioned at the beginning. My network for our team is so very important to us, because if I have a client and I have a vision for what I think they need that would fit their criteria, we can go find it. And if that same client was Googling, they might send us stuff, and likely either there's something about the deal that they didn't know or wasn't transparent at the beginning, or it's not available. So it is still a business of trust and relationships. Although I will say it's becoming a bit more transparent and there is more marketing being done overall. Digzy, there's some other sites people list, you know, properties on. But you still need that expert to help you unpack it and compare different deals.
Well, the one thing that I really want to drive home is I want to create some clarity here, because not everybody wants to list or put their property in the market, but they will sell at the right price or to the right, you know, investor. There's times when they sell and it's like they're actually partnering up with a new person coming in and they're creating a joint venture essentially. So, can you break down the components of why you need a good broker? Because it's not necessarily that they have access to all the same information. Carly can be talking to this part of town or this part of a different state and know, okay, this McDonald's will sell, this other people will sell, this CVS, they would entertain something, but it's not on the market. But then somebody else might be talking to a different person in that same market and they have some information that you probably don't do, which is probably a good broker networks with other brokers as well, to create that liquidity on what it's really more of a dark market. That's really what it is. What is a good broker, and what, I mean, you did a whole video on this, but when it talks to finding opportunities and that, you know, are very, they're not just there. I mean, they're just very few of them. What do you look like? What sets, let's forget it's Carly, but let's say you were hiring a broker, like, I want to talk about the opportunity side, not necessarily that they've been in the business for so many years, et cetera, et cetera. Like, how do I know that that person is going to find me deals?
There's a few points in there that I want to touch on. The first thing that you mentioned was off-market opportunities. And that's actually a pretty small part of the commercial real estate market, because there's such a low shorty of close. And it's funny, I have so many clients, potential clients who call and say, what do you have off market? That's all I want. But the reality is, if a seller is not willing to list with a credible broker in their specialty, in their market, they're probably not that serious about selling. So if you're going after off market deals, you probably, it's kind of like saying, I don't really think I want to move, but if someone brought me a crazy offer, maybe I'd think about it. Maybe you get that crazy offer and you don't move your house, right?
So yeah.
Commercial real estate. You have a lot of false starts if you go that way. So I truly believe it is a huge misnomer that the opportunities are found in off-market properties. I think the opportunities are found in understanding what you need and then finding the right people to find them for you. So the broker network is very important, and every broker has different strengths and specialties. You know, if someone came to me and they said, I really am looking for an industrial property in Seattle, I am not going to represent that client. I'm going to find someone and say, here you go. I'm not going to be involved. Here's someone I think you should talk to. You know, start there. If that doesn't work, we'll find somebody else. But you're not going to find one person to cover every asset class and every market. People do have different specialties. So if you're interviewing brokers, I think it depends if you're on the buy or the sale side. If you're on the sales side, you want to understand what their market presence is for the type of asset and the specific market that your property is located in. You want to understand how long they've been in the business, what their marketing presence and platform really is, because most deals are done without out-of-state buyers. I'd say over 50% of our transactions are actually out-of-state buyers as a company. And we do the largest transaction volume in the country in commercial real estate in the $2 to $15 million space. So 50% of those deals are out-of-state buyers. How do you find them? Not just by your one broker calling everyone they know, by marketing.
Yeah.
Standing the marketing platform and the partnerships with Digzy and firms like that are important. And if the broker's like, well, you know, we talk about it, we don't co-broke, we know the right buyer, it's probably not the right person.
Right, because you want different people bidding up the price.
You want as many, if you're a seller, as many eyes on your deal as possible. Keeping it to yourself and playing the it's exclusive, nobody gets to see it except for the chosen, you know, 10 people. That was a 15-year-old game.
Got it.
Let's get competitive. Let's get qualified buyers who we have proof of funds on, who we know are real, and get them fighting over the deal. That's how you boost pricing. So I do think it's changed a bit.
That's great. Yeah.
Last 10 years or so.
Yeah. Well, that's why you're the expert on. I'm just the person who watches from the bleachers. Have you seen any, like, what innovations are there on the marketing side for investment properties? Like either on whatever, like innovations just in general. Have you seen anything? Like, I've seen a lot more people doing like Matterport tours and drone tours, et cetera. You can't really go into the McDonald's and do this stuff, but a lot of drone stuff. Like, aside from that, like what things are you seeing?
We don't see a lot in my space because it's corporate tenants. So if we're selling a Walgreens, we're not taking, you know, photos or footage inside the Walgreens or inside the restaurant, inside the doctor's office. We do drone photos for every property. That's sort of become an absolute given. We would never bring something to market without drone, or we've even done helicopter photos if we really need to show a broad swath of the market. So drone photos are a must. I think the things that you're talking about, and you should probably jump in and tell me, because you can educate me more, maybe would be more relevant for leasing, for apartments, for industrial, things when the interior space matters much. I think it's fascinating. We just don't use it because of the corporate nature.
Well, it makes sense. You can't go into the space, right? And it's a lot more of an investment. It's a little bit more black and white a lot of the times. The nice thing, the best investments I personally like are the ones where, like, you buy the Walgreens and you find out you've got all this land behind it. And then you've got kind of like a future development or an exit strategy, or you can add on sort of like these value add transactions. Those are really, really interesting. And there's value add transactions that usually are pretty easy. It's just like, you just change the facade and the bones are already good. So if you look at it from the front, it looks magnificent. But if you look at it from the top or the back, you go, that building was built in like the early 80s it's funny, when I was a broker, I was like in my 20s. So what used to be like 1969, 1967, 1970s now is like, I feel old because the young brokers saying, oh, that was built in the 80s. I'm like, what the hell? But things do age.
Same age, so we don't.
Yeah. on the multifamily is really interesting. So you see a lot of Matterports like around. People want to know the property, and usually like the vacant units, they'll stage them and then they'll take the Matterports inside. That's really cool. On the leasing side, you know, 80% of the commercial leasing. Like if you look at transaction volume is sub 5,000 feet, which is like these tiny brokers don't make enough money there, but the landlords do. But a lot of the volume, a lot of the inventory is controlled by brokers, right? So that it's not like brokers go out and hunt, you know, a 2,000 square foot lease listing. What they do is they grab a bigger building, but that 10, 18,000 square foot space comes with this 1,500 or 3,000. And to maintain their relationship with the landlord, not only do they have to do a good job, they have to get this property's leased. And there's just been a very big price obstacle in trying to get these Matterport tours, et cetera? First of all, you get a lot of calls from people who have never leased space before, or who leased space 2 or 3 years before, or 5, 7 years. It's their first time moving again. And they just don't really recall because they're not in the market all the time. The terminology tends to be hard for the end consumer. So being able to have great photography and have Matterport tours, you don't see them a lot. But what I believe is going to be extremely disruptive is going to be when, instead of, you know, going and shooting out this Matterport tours for this $10-4 million property, you know, that's an investment. It's really the bottom end that where you don't make that much money that you want efficiency. Like, hey, here's everything, Mr. Tenant, Mrs. Tenant. You've got great photos. You got photos of the interior space, and you can walk the space on your own. Call me when you're ready. So like, basically you've got qualified leads coming in here. And there's a competitive wave too, where the people who are doing it are generating 50 to 70% more physical tours. But once everybody starts doing it, then it'll be like that. So whoever can actually crack the code and the cost of these, you know, virtual 3D experiences. So it's, you know, cheaper, faster, and easier, not only for the tenant to find space, but also cheaper, faster, and easier for a broker who's only making 5% of the total lease value. You know, you look at these leases, right? They're so small. Like, a broker's making $5,000. They split that with the house, $2,500, and they split it with three people. It's just not worth the time and energy. But because they have that 20,000 square foot floor plate, or this 50,000 square feet on larger spaces, you have to honor and do a good job for your landlord as if it was your own building. So that's kind of like the disconnect. This technology should actually be servicing the bottom end to make it efficient rather than that. But that's my rant on that.
No,
but
I think simplification is going to be the biggest disruptor, because it's a notoriously inefficient industry. Commercial real estate in general requires too many people, too many relationships, too many conversations. So any technology that simplifies things, exactly like you were just saying, is going to be huge.
Yeah. So I want to tease the audience before we go. So can you tell us just a little snapshot? You did a fantastic video on ghost kitchens, and I know you do a lot of stuff on the triple net leases. And I want to know, first question is, have you had investors approach you about this concept?
Absolutely. And a lot of my more professional clients, REITs, that I'm good friends with and like to kind of toss around ideas with, are very hot on ghost kitchens, and have been for years, actually. This is not a new COVID idea. This was in the works, but now it just has absolutely blown up. So ghost kitchens, for those listeners that don't know, aren't familiar with the terminology, is a completely virtual restaurant experience. So you have a kitchen that's off-site. There's no interface with the consumer. It could be anywhere. It does not have to be on a main retail road like a restaurant would have to be. And it's basically food preparation for delivery. Now, that delivery could go through a restaurant, or it could go just be a 100% digital brand that is being serviced out of a ghost kitchen. What's interesting is there's three different ways that this is kind of coming to the market. We have restaurants doing their own ghost kitchens. Chick-fil-A is a great example. They're beta testing some ghost kitchens right now. We have the third-party delivery apps, DoorDash, et cetera, you know, all of them, kind of coming together and starting ghost kitchens for their brands. And then we have a third wave of new companies that are just these digitally native food brands, which are starting. They don't have a brand that they're sort of distributing for. They are their own brand, and this is all they are. So we'll see. I think it's going to be a really competitive space. What's great from my perspective is they are starting to backfill some of our vacant retail spaces, even in shopping malls, you know, on some of those back spaces, because they don't need the frontage. They really can go anywhere. So as we have more and more vacancy, this is going to be a sustainable use that we're really going to be happy to see move in.
That's awesome. So that's all we're going to say. If you guys want to see a full scope on and information on ghost kitchens, Carly did a video on this on her YouTube channel. What's the name of your YouTube channel, Carly? Because I don't know. I just Google your name.
CRE Fast 5.
Got it. So CRE Fast 5, look them up, or find Carly on LinkedIn. I'll go ahead and link in the YouTube channel. I'll link it below. If you guys like this episode, please hit a thumbs up, subscribe. If you're in the social networks, if you're seeing this on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, whatever, do us a favor and leave us a like, a comment, and share with whoever you think that in your network that would drive value in this. Carly, I'm very sorry to hear that you were actually blacklisted and 86th from Africa. But I'm sure the rhinos appreciate it. And I hope to see you soon in some of our new videos.
That would be great. Looking forward to it, Andrew. Thanks so much.
Likewise. See you later.